We have come to a fork in the road to our future. One road will take us down the road toward capitalism, the other toward socialism. We must decide which road to take, and so today we pause to ask, which can best feed us, capitalism or socialism?
Welcome to the award-winning Food Chain Show with your host, Michael Olson. Now, get ready for an hour of What's Eating What Radio.
Well, hello out there. You are tuned in to the 769th edition of the Food Chain right here on News Talk Radio. Or hey, perhaps you're among our friends over there in the Tuscany who are tuned in as we stream along on the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com. Well, whoever you are and wherever you are, welcome aboard. I am Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What Radio with engineer Easton Allen on the boards. Hello, Easton.
Good morning, Michael.
Folks, in case you haven't noticed, it's an election year, which means that we have come to another fork in the road to our future. One road will take us toward capitalism, the other toward socialism. And so today we must think about which road we're going to be taking. First, let me define the terms I have placed on the table for us to talk about today. Capitalism is an economic system based on the private ownership of the means of production and the use of those means to create goods or services for profit. You own a patch of ground and some melon seeds. You believe I will be willing to pay money for the melons, and so invest your time, money, and know-how to sprout the seeds and tend the plants until you have some melons ready to sell. I taste your melons and compare them with your neighbors. If I select your melons and pay you enough money for them, you make a profit and stay in business. However, if I select your neighbor's melons, you suffer a loss and go out of business. Socialism is an economic system based on the community's ownership of the means of production and the cooperative management of those means to create products or services for the good of the community. The community owns a patch of ground and some melon seeds and decides via its central authority to provide the neighborhood with melons. The authority directs you and your neighbor to sprout the seeds and tend the melons. At harvest, the authority pays you a fair price for your work and requires me to pay a fair price for the melons. As there are no other melons from which to select, I will either pay the price or forgo the melons. We know of no communities that are purely capitalist, nor any that are purely socialist. More accurately, capitalism and socialism are directions communities take on the road to their future. As we are approaching a fork in the road to our future, and we'll have to decide which direction we take, we engage our decision-making process with a series of conversations about the politics of food here on the Food Chain. Today, we're very fortunate to have somebody who can really give us a hand in that direction. She is Julie Guthman, Professor of Community Studies at the University of California, Santa Cruz, and author of Weighing In: Obesity, Food Justice, and the Limits of Capitalism. Julie, hello, and welcome to the Food Chain.
Hi, Michael. Thank you for having me on the show.
Pleasure. Professor at my alma mater, UC Santa Cruz. Hey, let me ask you something, Julie. How on earth did UC Santa Cruz become such a mecca for foodies?
Well, you know, Santa Cruz itself has been ground zero for so many food movements, and the California Certified Organic Farmers got started in Santa Cruz. The Center for Agroecology and Sustainable Food System was started at UC Santa Cruz. CASFAS has been training farmers to grow organic food for 30 yeah. plus years. And so it's just,
is there a bug in the soil?
Itself, because we have so much abundance of wonderful foods to grow, it's just, people are attracted to it.
Maybe that's it. I just wonder because, I don't know, I went up there and I studied English and Chinese literature, ended up spending 769 Saturdays talking about food.
Yeah. Well, you know, I was an undergraduate at Santa Cruz too, and it was before food had kind of captured the national zeitgeist. So, even though I think there's been that tradition at the Santa Cruz campus for a long time, it's not until in the last 10 or 15 years when, all things food are what's on everybody's mind as Santa Cruz kind of reemerges as Mecca.
I think it's a bug in the soil. I think you hang around up there for a while and you just start thinking about food. That's it. I don't know. So the obesity crisis, your book, Obesity, Food Justice, and the Limits of Capitalism. May I read my favorite sentence from your book?
Of course.
Okay, this from Julie Guthman's Obesity, Food Justice, and the Weighing In, it's called. Obesity, Food Justice, and the Limits of Capitalism. We have a political economy that produces and makes available cheap food and goods, underpays people, and urges them to buy this food and these goods to keep the economy afloat. And then a culture that blames them for consuming this food and these goods after all. Boy, how did we get in this pickle?
I'm glad you like that line.
It goes along with Michael Olson's third law of the food chain, which is essentially cheap food isn't.
No, cheap food isn't. We've been producing cheap food in the United States for a very long time. And this is, we're not the only country in the world. Having food available cheaply often keeps the political machine working, right? When food is expensive, you get food riots, you have all sorts of discontent. So it's always in the national interest to have a cheap food supply, because it really supplements for when wage is low, and that's particularly true right now because our real wages are an all-time low. And so when people actually can't afford to buy what they need, having cheaper food supplements that wage.
Then what's wrong with the cheap food?
Well, what's wrong with the cheap food is it's nutritionally debilitated and toxic.
It's not really cheap after all, is it?
It's not really cheap after all, and the food that many of us value is more expensive to grow. And it's also more expensive because it's not subsidized in all the ways that cheap food is subsidized. And that doesn't only include, the commodity programs where farmers are paid to grow certain commodities like corn and soy, but it's also because they're subsidized by the lack of regulation.
Or by regulation, too.
Right.
Either way, it works in all kinds of different ways.
Absolutely.
And then... So how did we come to this point in our existence where we have cheap food that really isn't cheap? And people, what is the impact of that cheap food on the body politic, if not our bodies themselves?
The impact on the body politic, how did we come there? Our cheap food problem in part comes from a policy environment that's evolved over many years, but a lot of it stems from New Deal policies where the commodity programs were developed over the New Deal, and that was, the commodity programs were addressed to keep farmers in business. Every nation wants, it's a national food security issue. You want to keep farmers in business, and so in the 19th century in particular, and up in the first part of the 20th century, there were huge booms and bust cycles.
Which is the nature of farming, right?
Which is the nature of farming.
Yeah, and probably of all business when it gets right down to it.
Well, farming is more prone to boom and bust than any other mm-hmm. business because of the nature of farming, because you don't know the price, there's so many things that are unpredictable. You don't know the weather, you don't know the pests, and you don't know what other farmers are planting.
I know some real estate agents might disagree with you right now, but go ahead.
Oh, yeah, of course, real estate. Of course. But and so the original New Deal policies were designed to mitigate those booms and busts.
Mm-hmm.
So that's where some of the cheap food problem comes from.
Well,
what
impact did those programs have that were designed to eliminate the booms and busts? How did they impact or lead to cheap food?
Well, one of the things they did is because only certain crops were subsidized, like corn, like soy, and there's been different crops subsidized over the years, so they encouraged those farmers to grow those crops, not to grow a diversity of crops. And the other thing those programs encourage, they were supposed to decrease production so prices would remain high for farmers, but indeed what they encourage farmers to do is to intensify their production on the amount of land they had. So all these programs were like, don't expand your production, et cetera.
So then they develop all these, meanwhile,
all these other parts, you know, like the land grant universities, et cetera, were developing all these technologies that would allow farmers to get more out of a piece of land. So it didn't mitigate the problem of chronic excess. There was still too much crop on the market, and that's what, and when you have too much crops on the market, the prices come down, and that's partly what makes cheap food. But the other thing that makes cheap food, of course, is the food processing companies that, in order to be profitable, they make their profits on substituting, you know, real ingredients with analogs, you know, like, so synthetic, you know.
Can you hold that? We're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we're going to talk about taking something that costs a penny and turning it into something that costs a dollar. And that's cheap food. Folks, this is the Food Chain Radio program. Michael Olson here. Today we're talking with Professor Julie Guthman, University of California, and the author of Weighing In, Obesity, Food Justice, and the Limits of Capitalism. It's election year. Do stay tuned. Right back.
Get this. The average acre of farmland in or near the city limits may earn in excess of $123,000 per year. To learn how so much can be earned from so little, pick up a copy of Metro Farm, the guide to growing for big profit on a small parcel of land. Metro Farm is the PMA Ben Franklin Book of the Year Award winner by Michael Olson that contains over 500 pages of photos, charts, checklists, illustrations, and in-depth interviews. Metro Farm will teach you how to develop a strategy, survey markets, select crops, organize business, establish production, prepare for market, and make the sale. Metro Farm will teach you how others just like you earn a good living by growing high-value specialty crops for people who are truly appreciative. Abraham Lincoln said, "The greatest fine art of the future will be the making of a comfortable living from a small parcel of land." Get in on that future today. Pick up a copy of Metro Farm at bookstores, lawn and garden supply stores, 1-800-624-BOOK, or at www.metrofarm.com.
Hey folks, it's election year, and we are talking the politics of food on the food chain with Julie Guthman. Professor Julie Guthman, author of Weighing In, Obesity, Food Justice, and the Limits of Capitalism. We were talking about, you said something, Julie, that really struck me, which is it's in the government's best interest to have lots of corn and soybeans. You didn't quite put it that way, but...
No, I didn't put it quite like that.
But that's the way it stuck in my head, and I got to thinking that really is government food, isn't it? And they really do need to have a lot of it. And so they probably will continue to support it in one way or another because they just need to have a lot of food. And nobody wants to be the king with a pantry full of food when everybody else is hungry.
Well, yeah. I mean, it's always been a way of making your citizenship relatively happy to make sure there's a decent food supply. And when food prices are really high, people rebel. I actually am a supporter of government. I think we need governance. I think we need more regulation. So I don't necessarily see that as a problem. I think that we subsidize the wrong source of things.
Well, that'll be a subject as we pick up, that we could pick up as we go along.
Yeah. Well,
let's go back to how we're taking this. You know, something that costs a penny a bushel and turning it into something that costs $100 a bushel. And that really is cheap food that you're talking about, right?
Well, the bushels are still cheap. Where the value added in food is, of course, in food processing. And
right.
So you're getting the ingredients that go in so many processed foods are extraordinarily cheap to produce. And they're cheap not only because of the subsidies, but because a lot of these commodity crops we're talking about are highly mechanized. And so the economies of scale when you're growing corn and soy are huge. And because there's intense price competition among farmers. And the major food, you know, grain buyers, of course, play them off against each other. So the ingredients are quite cheap in the food. And then where all the profits are made, of course, is in packaging and marketing.
But
so the cost, you know, when we buy processed food, the relationship between the actual cost of production and the profits that are making are pretty, they're pretty attenuated.
Mm-hmm. And they do not go to the farmer. They generally tend to go to the processor.
Absolutely, and the market and the retailers, of course.
So how do we get fat from that? Or obese, or whatever the proper term
well,
is.
Well, yeah, I mean, the argument I make in the book is that we is that it's not only the food that is making us fat, but it's the ways in which we're producing the food.
Now this is interesting. What do you mean by that?
Yeah, well, there's many of the chemicals that we're using in food production now appear to be obesogenic. And this is a relatively new science. I was just reading another report on it this morning before we got on the show. But there's quite a bit of evidence that right now that shows that a range of environmental toxins, and particularly agricultural chemicals, are likely causing our growth and girth. And we all assume it's about what we eat and how much we eat. And the evidence for that is not entirely clear. So there, you know, one of the points of my book is that we think we understand the causes of obesity, and we might not. And environmental toxins is one really important place to look.
What are some of these toxins? Because I'm not sure I've ever heard of obesogenics.
There's a lot of material coming out on now, but bisphenol A has gotten some attention recently. The FDA just decided that bisphenol A was okay after all. But bisphenol A is used in dental sealants. It's used in plastic. It lines soup cans. It's used in all sorts of plastics. It was in those Nalgene water bottles, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
And bisphenol A has been linked to both obesity and type 2 diabetes. There's been some work on tributylatin. It's used in on the paint.
You know, all of these sound so delicious, Julie.
I know. Yeah. And some of the herbicides. I mean, you know, there's at this point quite a range of chemicals mm-hmm. that have been linked to obesity, and some of this is through lab animal studies, and some mm-hmm. of it is through in vitro studies, and some of it is through epidemiological studies.
Now, what about the other side, though, the side that most of us think about, the fact that we're getting obese because we're eating a lot of empty calories?
Right. It's hard to know. I mean, if you look at... there's this wonderful book called The Obesity Epidemic, Science, Ideology, I forgot the other part of the subtitle, by Michael Gard and Jen Wright. And they looked at hundreds of studies in an attempt to demonstrate that it's people are eating more or exercising less than they were a generation or two ago before this so-called obesity epidemic took off. And it's just not clear that that's the case. There's obviously studies that contradict other studies, but one study I came across was one by the USDA, and it was based on national health surveys, and this didn't speak to if people are eating more than they did a generation ago, but what the study did show is on a per capita basis that people in the for instance in higher income brackets that are generally much thinner than people who are in low-income brackets, do not eat fewer calories. So there's a lot of evidence that suggests that calories aren't telling us, aren't
the
explaining
whole story.
The story. Now, it may well be true that the kinds of foods we eat are also more obesogenic, and this is research that I'm just starting to learn about, but, you know, we are learning more and more about, for instance, that the kind of refined carbohydrates probably do metabolize differently than whole grains mm-hmm. and therefore make us more prone to obesity. Now there's interesting research too that suggests the time of day in which we eat matters in terms of our fat retention. So there's a whole lot of stuff going on besides calories. And
right.
again, all the attention is on calories.
Well, that's fair enough. But the conclusion, though, is do you agree with the conclusion that we are obese as a nation, that we are gaining
too
much?
Well, I agree that I would be an idiot to suggest that to say otherwise. I mean, that people have gotten, there's no question that people have gotten bigger since about 1980 as on average. Where I differ with a lot of the discussion of obesity is what we you know, how we interpret those differences and whether all, that's necessarily bad and whether our rush to try to fix it is doing any good.
So what would you say then to people who would ask, why are we becoming obese?
Well, you know, I mean, bodies have changed over the course of human history. And, you know, there's been times where people have become a lot taller as well. We don't make much ado about that. So, I mean, bodies change. Now, but nevertheless, I mean, there has been a significant change in body size and girth since 1980. And that, you know, it bears explanation to suggest that it doesn't. It's, you know, it's like, sounds like crazy. But, again, I think that a lot of the causes of this, where we all assume it's about calories in and calories out, it looks like environmental toxins and pollutants are a big piece of this, and we're not looking in that.
Okay.
But, you know, the other thing I just want to emphasize in terms of those statistics is there's a lot hidden when we just talk about this obesity epidemic. There's a lot hidden in those statistics. So if you kind of start parsing them out, you see that on average the weight gain since then is about 20 pounds per person, which may or may not be significant. Now, what we have seen is the growth in very, very large people, and I'm talking, you know, people 400 or 500 pounds, and that is it's odd, and it's hard to imagine that that can be easily explained just by eating habits again.
More likely, a governing mechanism is broke. You know, another one of my favorite things in your book was a quote from a student. Why do fat people make us mad?
Yeah.
And that is something we're going to pick up when we get back. And we'll use it to introduce your thoughts on food justice and what exactly that means. Folks, this is Michael Olson. I am hosting the Food Chain Radio program with Julie Guthman. Professor Julie Guthman, author of Weighing In, Obesity, Food Justice, and the Limits of Capitalism. It's election year. We're talking food politics. Why not? What makes you hungry and what's eating what? Do stay tuned. We will be right back. Well, this from one of Professor Julie Guthman's students. It's weird, but I've never realized obesity was such an emotional issue. It's so political, but not just for fat people. I mean, most of the people in this class that have strong viewpoints aren't themselves fat, but I get the feeling that they are anti-fat. Why do fat people make people mad? Well, Professor Julie Guthman, how'd you answer that one?
Well, that's kind of one of the things that impelled me to write this book, because, you know, I work with all these really wonderful students at UC Santa Cruz that are very, very interested in changing food systems, and, you know, they love local organic food, and I do too in certain respects, but they, you know, they're very engaged, they're very they're very committed to this. And so I when I was, you know, I always at the beginning of the classes I teach ask them why they want to study this and what they hope, what are their social change aspirations around this, because that's been kind of the heart of the community studies major. Students do field studies with social change organizations around food, and with my students around food. So I was curious about what kind of got them interested in that. And people started, you know, talking about, well, the obesity epidemic, and they're so fat. And I started getting really curious about why that was becoming the motive for their change efforts. And then I taught this class on the politics of obesity, and that's the quote that came from, and I was like shocked at particularly the first time I taught it, how much vitriol there was in the classroom around fat people. And these are students that, for the most part, like, they do consider themselves quite liberal, and they consider themselves anti-corporate, and so I was really trying to understand that. And over the time, I've realized a lot of the kind of investments that people who buy, not only people who buy local organic food, but there's so much deep investment in people who are thin in their own self practices, and when they see people who are fat, they see them as having less efficacy, less self efficacy, and less self control, and that somehow that seems to be an affront to people with deep investments in their own bodies.
In which we all seem to have these days. It's a body focused culture now, right?
Absolutely, absolutely.
So how does this take us into your part of the title of your book is social justice? What do you mean by food justice? Yeah. What do you mean by food justice?
Well, the food justice movement it's a movement I'm very deeply sympathetic with, and the food justice movement is one of several iterations of what I call the alternative food movement, which is the movement that is encouraging, is wanting to change the food system through creating these alternatives like local, like community food security, et cetera, that seem to be in juxtaposition to the industrial food system. And a lot of the iterations of this movement have come out of critiques of organics, because organics didn't solve or didn't address all the social justice issues that I think people were hoping for in an alternative. Organics, I buy and eat organics all the time. Organics certainly produce less.
Julie, they'd throw you in jail if you didn't.
Yes, I know. It's less toxic, but, issues about worker rights, about affordability aren't addressed through organics. And in fact, organics are designed to cost more. That's one of the critiques I make in the book, in my previous book, Agrarian Dreams. And so food justice really is one of the many kind of iterations of the movement that emerged to address that. That the good food that's all extolled is expensive and isn't available in a lot of low-income neighborhoods, communities of color. And so the food justice movement has been really about trying to bring this good food to those neighborhoods. And I'm sympathetic to that. And yet my concern remains that we're focusing on food consumption and not food production.
Okay.
That it's not enough to just simply bring better food, that a lot of the problems in the food system come through the way we produce it.
Okay, and that kind of takes us to the third issue, which is the limits of capitalism. And when you talk about the limits of capitalism, you point to neoliberalism, which, of course, to most of us would mean a new student at UC, but that's not
that's funny.
That's not what you're saying when you say neoliberalism at all. What is a neoliberal?
Neoliberalism is, it's a word that's used, it's used in academia quite a bit. It's also used, it's in relationship to a set of policies that have become quite popular since 1980. And the idea of neoliberalism is, it's a notion that it's become kind of taken for granted, the idea that government is the problem and the government needs to reduce its role in the economy, and that the market itself is the best allocator of goods and services. And so neoliberalism really emerged in 1980, and it was in response to many of the kind of policies that had been developed in the New Deal, mm-hmm. where the government took a stronger role in regulating particular activities and in redistribution. And so when Reagan came into office in 1980, he was like kind of the first person the first president embarking on a neoliberal agenda, and he really saw the government, he claimed that he saw the government's role as a problem. Now, of course, he built up a huge military, which is still government, but that's another story. And so the idea here is that the government is a problem and that the market is the best way to regulate.
Did Reagan get rid of all of the price supports in the government food?
Well, no, that's what's so interesting. I mean, after, now we've had 30 years of moral, at least neoliberal rhetoric, that our food supply is not neoliberalized at all. I mean, the government takes a strong role.
It's probably even more.
Absolutely. And what's happened around the world is other governments, kind of drank the Kool-Aid of neoliberal politics and reduced their subsidies really to quite some harm for both farmers and consumers, and the U.S. has not, nor has the EU.
Okay, so you're suggesting then, if I read you rightly, that what we need is to have more government involved in the food chain.
I think our government needs to be involved differently in the food chain. I think that, going back to these chemicals, I think that, you know, the chemical we have, you know, the chemicals we use in our food, in, you know, in food processing, but also in agriculture, are horrendous. And, you know, the Environmental Protection Agency was developed in 1970, and one of its first things it did was to outlaw, to, you know, to ban DDT, which I think we can all agree is a good thing. And then really starting with the Reagan era, the agencies like the EPA were told to not enforce. And so we have, you know, hundreds, thousands of chemicals that are used in commercial use that are known or probable carcinogens, and now there's more evidence about their role in endocrine disruption.
In spite of the fact that we have this massive government bureaucracy set up. Folks, this is the Food Chain. Michael Olson here with Professor Julie Guthman. And you, we're going to open up the phones. If you'd like to participate, pick up your phone and join us at 831-479-1080, 831-479-1080. What do you think? Do you think that we can fix this with a different set of procedures with government? If government acts differently, can we fix this mess that we find ourselves in? 831-479-1080. Michael Olson, Julie Guthman, and you on the Food Chain. Right back. Do stay tuned. Hey, folks, Michael Olson here. It's an election year. We're talking politics of food with Professor Julie Guthman, author of Weighing In, Obesity, Food Justice, and the Limits of Capitalism. Professor Julie, you seem to say that to fix things, we have to get the government to act differently, whereas the neoliberals, which are not new students to UC, suggest that we should get the government out of the process. You suggest that we have to get the government to act differently. How do we get the government to act differently?
How is it? I know we need to. How is a very difficult question, obviously. We're in a political time. I'm not sure everybody on your show, I don't know your listeners that well. I'm not sure we all agree. But I think almost
well,
all of us
guarantee
agree
you about,
that we're...
There's one thing about our audience, Julie, that they never agree on anything.
But I'm sure we can all agree we're in a very difficult time politically. And I'm quite frustrated with the direction most people are, but in different ways. One thing is that we, from my perspective, is there's far too much corporate involvement in the political
elections. That would be my question. You know, I look at how we get the government to act differently, and what I see is the food safety czar for the United States of America is Michael Taylor from the Monsanto Corporation. Well,
right. The revolving door.
Yeah,
that's a real problem.
How on earth do we get the government to act differently when the government really only ever acts in its own self-interest, and thus we have all of those acres of corn and soybeans that you're talking about?
I don't buy this idea. I don't buy the idea that the government has a self-interest. I mean, we have this thing called the public sector. I mean, whatever world we're going to live in, there has to be some way in which we need to govern ourselves. I know there's many, you know, anarchists around, but I think even anarchists think about how to govern themselves. And so, the government is made up of all sorts of people and all sorts of agencies. It's not a monolith by a long shot. You know, yes, there's bureaucratic logics, but, the government is indeed a public sector, and so the question is how to make our public sector more public and less corporate.
Well, that's what I asked you.
Yeah, well, clearly, among other things, we need, you know, campaign finance reform. And, you know, the Supreme Court recently made a decision that went completely in the wrong direction on this. You know, we need stronger codes that'll, you know, eliminate the ability of major corporations to lobby.
But that's what puzzles me is that it seems like big companies go to Washington, D.C. and pay the government to make stronger laws so that little companies can't compete with them.
I don't think...
Should we take some phone calls?
Sure.
All right. Millie, are you there?
Yes.
Welcome to the Food Chain, Millie. You're talking with Professor Julie Guthman. Fire away.
Oh, it's a wonderful pleasure. I'm going to make a very short statement and followed by a specific question. Over 100 years ago, maybe closer to 120, we were still basically an agrarian society, and people worked very hard on the farms with a huge meal midday and a very light meal, as I recall. Not that I was around then. No.
Hey, you know, Millie, I worked there in 120 years ago. I worked on ranches, and you're exactly right.
Yeah.
We had so huge meals.
These people were working their calories off for sure. There was literally no obesity among that class of people, which was a large class. Now I'm getting to metabolism. Professor, you touched on the importance, I would assume you think it's important, of when we eat. I believe that we should not eat large meals at night, and almost all these sedentary people are doing that, and this affects the metabolism when they go to sleep after maybe only an hour or almost at the same time in some cases. The metabolism slows down. So what do you think about that?
That's a great question, Millie. You know what I call that? I call that pizza dreams.
Yeah, junk food.
Thank you very much for the call, Millie. What do you think, Julie?
Well,
wrong time of day?
This research on metabolism is actually something I've learned quite recently since writing this book. And I think it's really interesting, and there does seem to be evidence, again, that the timing of day of when we eat matters in terms of metabolism. And I think that that's important science to know, because it's one of the ways in which the current conversation of obesity isn't incorporating all this new, really interesting science. And yet I'm still kind of concerned about the idea that if we only kind of can figure out what will make people thinner, that then we can tell them and they'll be thin. I mean, I think that there's kind of a little bit too much of beating up on people who are fat today. And, you know, people have really difficult lives. And if eating pizza before bed is a pleasure for them, so be it. And so I'm kind of really reluctant to get on this idea that, like, we really, if we get the science right and communicate it well, that we can make people thin.
There you go.
I think that's the kind of thing that is also motivating this book. As much as I completely appreciate that there's something really important we need to understand about metabolism.
Okay, folks, Food Chain Radio, call in 831-4790. Professor Julie Guthman, what do you think? Should we have more government to fix what's wrong with us? Do stay tuned. We will be right back. Well, folks, we have so much to talk about. It's an election year, and we're talking politics of food, and we have Professor Julie Guthman, author of Weighing In, Obesity, Food Justice, and the Limits of Capitalism. We have everything except lots of minutes. So we're going to go to the phones and rip and see what we can get done. Richard, are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Fire away.
Hi. I'd like to make a statement quickly about the fact that the end of capitalism is greed. I think we're seeing that it has its limits, and that that alone would call for...
Well, where's capitalism? Have you seen any around lately?
No, but I do know that people are getting a lot greedy, and it's the greediness.
Uh-huh.
It's at the heart of many of our problems. But anyway, I wanted to just elaborate on two elephants in the political room. One is the relation... These are things that the political machinery just simply isn't even talking about, and that is the relationship between farm subsidies and national health, which I think is at the root of the whole thing.
Well, wait a minute. Julie, you've been talking a lot about that.
And the second elephant in the political room is the fact that all these chemicals and all this method of production is based on a non-renewable resource called fossil fuels. And when they run out, eventually things are going to have to change. They're going to have to change because our entire agricultural system is based on a non-renewable resource.
Mm-hmm.
So what I've done, and I've told my students this, if they want to affect change, support your local food economy and establish food sheds, began working with local situations, modes of distribution, processing. The government may or may not be involved or help. I don't think the government's capable of understanding the depth of the problem.
Well, do you think that my question is, who's going to feed us when the government goes broke?
Well, this is a very good question, because a lot of people can't go back to the land.
No.
You know, unlike many countries where people can go back to the land like we did in the recession, we can't do that anymore.
Well, you seem to be talking about the same things that Professor Julie is.
Oh, yeah. That's why I'm listening.
Okay. Well, thank you very much. Julie, do you have a comment?
That we do have this huge fiscal crisis right now of the government, and that's it worries me tremendously. I mean, the thing about local food systems, I mean, there's ways in which, there's a way in which if indeed all things fall apart, that's all there will be. And yet I still worry about some of the rhetoric around local food systems, because I do think it kind of limits, this is my colleague Patricia Allen has said this, it really limits the world we care about. And it's, you know, particularly on the Central Coast when we have such an abundance of food available year-round, it's quite a conceit to suggest that this is a recipe for the rest of the world.
Yeah, what about Vermont maple syrup, right?
Yeah. I mean, local food in Saskatchewan might not cut it. One of the things I briefly talk about in the book is that we have a large world economy that's been made, has been integrated over hundreds of years right now, and many people around the world depend on their livelihoods from exporting. And so this kind of withdrawal to the local, which has some good reasons for it, including the question of fossil fuels, also can serve to impoverish people who are already quite impoverished. And so one of the points of the book is to really deeply think about inequality, which again I think has been wrought by unregulated capitalism. And so for us to really think about a better food system, we have to simultaneously address inequality.
Okay, Julie, then the question remains, which direction should we take, more capitalism or more socialism?
Well, I just want to say I never use the word socialism in the entire book.
I know you didn't, but I'm using it right now.
But I am quite clear that the unregulated capitalism that currently, in my mind, dominates the world we live in right now.
Okay, out of time, but I get your direction. Professor Julie, thanks for joining us. And thank you all out there for tuning in The Food Chain. Sorry, out of time.
You've been listening to the award-winning Food Chain Show with Michael Olson. If your friends missed the show today, tell them to log on to the radio page at www.metrofarm.com for a listen. Now go out and find some food with a farmer's face on it and live.